The following podcast is for healthcare professionals only. All views expressed belong to our speakers and don't necessarily reflect those of Nestlé Health Science.
Hello and welcome to the Inside Medical Nutrition podcast, a podcast powered by Nestlé Health Science and hosted by me, Dr. Linya Patel. In today's episode, I'm speaking with Smriti Venkat, a speech and language therapist who works in stroke rehabilitation. Hi, Smriti, and welcome to the Inside Medical Nutrition podcast. So today we're going to be doing a deep dive and learning into about your expertise and experience working within stroke rehabilitation. So we're going to be talking about things like dysphagia competencies and different swallowing difficulties. But before we go into all of that, I would love us if you could tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I was actually born and brought up in India. Okay. I completed my undergraduate degree in India as well. It was a dual degree in audiology and speech and language therapy. Mm-hmm. And once I completed my bachelor's, I sort of decided to go down the speech and language therapy route, especially working with individuals who had neurological disorders.
Okay.
So I got a job in a neurological rehabilitation center. It was a brain and spine rehabilitation center. And I worked there for a year in India. And then I chose to come over to the UK, where I completed my master's degree in language pathology at Newcastle University. And currently I'm working as a specialist speech and language therapist in acute stroke and dysphagia.
Okay. Wonderful, wonderful journey and transition. So what does a typical day look like for you?
So here I work on the acute stroke ward in the hospital. And as a specialist speech and language therapist, our primary focus really is to help individuals who've had a stroke regain their communication and swallowing abilities. So, and acute wards are usually very, very dynamic and things are constantly changing. So all patients need to be evaluated on a constant everyday basis. So typically my day begins with checking the ward list, reviewing patient charts and a nursing handover. And sometimes a multidisciplinary team meeting where we discuss the goals and rehab requirements for all patients. Usually after this morning nursing handover or MDT, we prioritize patients based on their needs. So we have a red, amber, green prioritization system. So red being patients that are really urgent to be seen.
Okay.
So someone's ill by mouth or not having anything to eat and drink, they might need an urgent swallow assessment. So they would be prioritized as a red.
Okay.
And ambers are the ones that are not as urgent as the red ones and maybe having some routine assessments or therapies. And green are the ones that are least priority, maybe just an indirect check-in or just to check in how they're doing, those kind of things. And yeah, so usually my day begins with assessing the patients who are prioritized as the red. So it might be a swallow assessment, communication assessment, and then moving on to the other patients, implementing tailored therapy plans to improve their speech and language skills, cognitive skills, or their swallowing abilities. And sometimes as part of my day, I'm also involved in training other professionals. So healthcare assistants, nurses, other doctors and consultants who work in the hospital around dysphagia. So we do a lot of training with other professionals as well.
Yeah. That sounds really interesting. And so you talked a little bit around swelling issues that obviously you come across within the ward. Can you tell me a little bit more about what swallowing issues you come across on a regular basis? Is it always the same one or are there a number of different ones?
So typically each stroke patient presents very differently based on the lesion and the site of the stroke. Swallowing abilities is impacted in different ways. Mm-hmm. So typically most common impairments that we see in stroke are a oral motor weakness or incoordination. So because of the brain being affected in certain parts, they could be paralyzed on one half of the body. And the same can be seen in the face and other oral motor structures. So they could have weakness on one side. So that could affect their ability to move their tongue, their lips, their hard palate, the soft palate, and all these parts might be affected. Okay. The second type of difficulties we see is with sensation. So they can't tell the difference between different kinds of foods, whether it's hot or cold. Sometimes they can't, they don't realize that there's residue in their mouths because they don't have the sensation to realize that there's food still stuck in their mouths. So sensation is quite an important deficit that we quite often see. The other thing is just the entire coordination of the swallow process. So when we think about normal swallowing, obviously when we're normal and we're eating and drinking every day, we don't often think about how complex the process is. Yeah. But it's actually, according to literature, it's a four-stage process.
So
initially you're preparing the food in the mouth. That's the oral preparatory stage. And then you have the oral stage where you're moving the food from the front of the mouth into the back.
Yeah.
The third stage is the pharyngeal stage where you're pushing the food down your throat. And the fourth is the esophageal stage where it's going down your food pipe. And all these stages have to happen simultaneously and sequentially for you to safely swallow food. But in patients who've had a stroke, any or all of these stages might be affected.
Yeah.
So the coordination, when it's impaired, it results in coughing or choking and aspiration events, which might eventually lead to a chest infection as well. So those are the common difficulties we see in stroke, really. But the other important bits, which are very tiny but quite often noticeable, are cognitive difficulties associated with stroke. So sometimes some people who are cognitively impaired might not know how much food to eat. Might need to be supported with their feeding. They might also show some behavioral difficulties, like pacing too quickly when they're eating. There are also other difficulties such as inattention or neglect of one side. So when you put a plate of food, it might be very interesting to observe a patient who's inattentive to, say, their weaker side. They might finish only half the plate of food, but they can't actually see the other half. So those kind of difficulties are quite different from other populations or other patients who present with this stage. Those are some of the difficulties we observe.
That is so interesting. I never actually ever thought about staging swallowing into the different stages, but it perfectly makes sense. So when you're doing an assessment, are those assessments all standard? And what does an assessment actually look like when you are looking at a stroke patient?
So the important thing to note in stroke care, when a patient is admitted with a stroke, they need to have a compulsory swallow screen.
Okay.
Every patient who's admitted with a stroke, and that doesn't have to be a by speech and language therapist, but anyone. So usually we have nurse practitioners or dysphagia trained nurses who perform the screen as soon as the patient enters the hospital and is suspected to have a stroke. If there are any difficulties on this initial swallow screen, and prior to the swallow screen, they can't be given any food, drink, or any medications even. So once have had the swallow screen, and if there are any difficulties found on the swallow screen, they're immediately referred to a speech and language therapist.
Okay.
And they need to have a specialist assessment within 24 hours, ideally, and no later than 72 hours. So as speech and language therapists, what we do is we initially perform a bedside swallow screen. And as part of the bedside swallow screen, we essentially, the first bit is to take a detailed case history of the patient, what their stroke symptoms are, why they've come in, how they've come in, what kind of speech or swallowing difficulties are they presenting with.
Yeah.
And then we move on to a very detailed cranial nerve assessment and an oral motor assessment. So most often when you have a brain injury, obviously the different cranial nerves which originate from the brain can be affected, which is why your swallowing might be affected as well. So we assess the different cranial nerves involved in swallowing in a detailed fashion. And we also see what their oral motor status is. How does their mouth look like? Can they move all their mouth oral structures appropriately? Is there any weakness? Is there any paralysis? Is there any incoordination that might impact on their eating and drinking? And so that's really the initial bits. And the next bit we move on to is actually giving them food and drink to see how they do. And the International Dysphagia Diet Standardization Initiative, or the IDSI, to move through the hierarchy. So we give them different textures of food and drink to see which texture goes down the safest. And we're really looking for any overt signs of aspiration. So are they coughing? Are they throat clearing? Are they having some wet voice quality? Are they eye watering? So anything that's very obvious on the outside. Yeah. And we also touch and feel their swallow. So we palpate their neck. And we're really looking for that laryngeal elevation and excursion, which is typically expected when we're swallowing. So even if, say, you're having a drink of water and you put four fingers on your neck, you should feel your voice box blow up.
I'm doing it now and I can feel it. Yeah.
So it'll move upwards and outwards. So we typically try and do this whilst doing a swallow assessment. So it's a really special skill that we develop over time, and it varies from patient to patient. But this is really the standard protocol of the assessment. And once, if we can identify any textures that they're safe on from the bedside assessment, we'll keep them on those textures based on those ITSE levels. But if a patient turns out to be unsafe, or we can't identify anything that they are safe on, or if we suspect that they might be at risk for silent aspiration, which means things are going down into the lungs without showing any signs, we might refer them further on for a more specialist instrumental assessment, like a video fluoroscopy or a fiber optic endoscopy of their swallowing. But that's really what we do with every patient.
Yeah. And how long does that whole process take?
Again, it is really variable. So for a bedside swallow screen, it can be, for some patients, it can be as quick as 15 minutes where, you know, they're fine with most textures and they're eating and drinking normally. But with really complicated patients, it might take almost an hour, just the bedside screen, because sometimes people come into hospital and their oral status is so poor. We don't understand the significance of oral care. Obviously, when we're normal, we're up and about and we're brushing our teeth twice a day and our oral cavity is nice and clean. But for patients who've had a stroke and maybe they've been poorly for a while, their oral cavity isn't as clean as we would expect it to be. So a lot of time might go into oral mouth care and cleaning their mouth before actually giving them something to eat and drink. Or if they have cognitive issues, behavioral issues, the assessment just might take much longer than someone who's coping quite well.
That's really interesting. I was talking to you earlier before we started recording, and I told you that my mom had a stroke and she was diagnosed with dysphagia. And at the end, we also started realizing that the oral health was really important because she was holding foods, for example. So that's an important thing to also note. Smriti, what I want to focus on a little bit now is dysphagia. So that, what is the actual definition of dysphagia before we start talking about the competencies? Is that the right word? No. From the top, Oliver, when you're recording that. When you're cutting that. So I'll ask that question again, Smriti, if that's okay. So what I want to do now, Smriti, is focus a little bit on dysphagia. And so before we talk about the competencies linked with it, what is the actual definition of dysphagia?
Yeah. So if we pick up on the word, so the word dys obviously just means abnormality.
Yeah.
Phagia, it means swallowing. So dysphagia, the term, just means an abnormality in swallowing. So like I explained previously, the different phases of swallowing, the difficulties can be at any phase.
Yeah.
So it might be just the oral stage, or it can be the pharyngeal stage, or some individuals might have just problems with the esophageal stage. But dysphagia essentially means any of these stages, if there is a problem, someone has a swallowing difficulty and they are dysphagic. So that's essentially what dysphagia is.
No, thanks for clarifying that. So talk to me a little bit more about the competencies. What are they? Why were they created? And what's happened since they've been developed?
Right. So the RCSLT developed these competencies in 2014. So they're called the Eating, Drinking, and Swallowing Competencies Framework.
Okay.
And these are dysphagia competencies. It's really a set of standards. So knowledge, skills, and understanding required for professionals who work with patients supporting their eating and drinking. Mm-hmm. I think an important thing to highlight is that it's not just for speech and language therapists or instead of professionals, really. It's for anyone who supports someone with eating and drinking. So the standards go from, it's divided into 6 levels, and it goes from beginner to expert, and they cover a wide range of topics, including anatomy and physiology of swallowing, assessment and management of dysphagia, and ethical and legal issues. But it also has some very specific information on how to support someone with their eating and drinking. And it's not specific to any patient population. It's just a general framework across all patients, really.
Okay.
And since these competencies were developed, they've been used to inform training programs and assessment frameworks in dysphagia. And they've also been used to develop resources for professionals who work with people with dysphagia. And it really is an important tool to improve the quality of care for people with dysphagia, and also have a standardized care across the country, really.
Mm-hmm.
So even if I say I was treated in Newcastle or down in London, I should receive the same standard of care across the country. So the trust I trained in, we had an in-house competency program based on these EDSCF competencies introduced by the RCSLT, and it was spread across 6 months. And I had a specific number of patients to see across that period of time, starting with as simple as mealtime observations. So just sitting with someone, observing them eating, identifying the difficulties, and then slowly moving up the hierarchy to a specialist level of assessment, which is the level 5 in their competencies. And while doing my competencies, even though I primarily work with stroke patients, I had to train with various other acute dysphagia patients. And I also had opportunities to shadow therapists who work with other specialist populations, such as Parkinson's, motor neuron disease, pediatric dysphagia, and learning disabilities as well.
Mm-hmm.
So what the RCSLT has now pushed to do is introduce these competencies in university. So students who are coming out now or will graduate from this year onwards will have these EDSCF competencies integrated into practice.
Oh, brilliant.
And
within their placements?
Within their placements and their education as well. So we have a dysphagia module, and it's probably going to be included along with that. So these students will come out dysphagia trained or qualified. And I think it'll be much more well thought of and planned by the time they enter the field as a speech and language therapist. I think it really has supported me as a professional, because when I worked in India, although I did swallowing assessments and management even when I was in India, this is a very comprehensive protocol and comprehensive list of things to consider whilst
and it's standardized as well.
Yeah. And it's really useful to just have those things in front of you and tick through while you're doing a swallow assessment or when you're training, mainly. Once you're qualified, you have those things in your mind all the time because you've seen so many patients. But whilst you're training, it's really useful to have a set of things to consider. So it has things like cultural awareness, dietary preferences, religious considerations, which are not things that you would consider on the top of your head when you're doing an assessment. But it's a good checklist to have. It also gets you to think about the environment, what kind of other referrals you should make. Yeah, so it's a really useful resource.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so you've already shared some examples, I guess, of how the competencies have been supported in best practice, like asking more lateral questions about family, environment, etc. Can you give us any other examples, perhaps? As you move from maybe the lower level and as you go up, how that changes and evolves over time?
Yeah. So the first level really is public health messages and awareness, that first level of the competencies. So that's really for anyone who's reading about dysphagia and wanting to know more about dysphagia. But the level 2 and 3 would be care plan implementation and identification and implementation of an interim eating and drinking plan. So as speech and language therapist, we make the recommendations of what someone should be eating or drinking, and we give them a comprehensive care plan of what kind of utensils they might need, how they should be supported with their eating and drinking. But it really is the healthcare assistants or the nurses on the ward who are implementing these plans.
Okay.
So the EDSEF competencies has long useful recommendations for them in terms of best practice. And it just is the smallest of recommendations, really, positioning the patient upright before they eat and drink, especially in the stroke population when someone's paralyzed on one side, they don't really have the ability to sit themselves upright, or they might be flat on the bed and they need to be assisted to upright, or someone needs to be in like a specialist setting without any distractions to be eating and drinking. So it gives you really nice examples of best practice in these terms, getting someone to wash their hands before eating and drinking. When in hospital, when someone's independently doing these things, they'll automatically do it. But when they're in hospital and someone will support them to do this, these are quite handy to remember. So thinking about the lighting and environment, thinking about their vision, do they need their glasses while they're eating, and things like that. And little things like this make a huge difference.
No, absolutely.
So when we make these recommendations, we're usually training at the level 4 and 5. So we also train the nurse practitioners and other dysphagia qualified nurses at level 4, so they can do a protocol guided assessment. So it's a very clean and clear protocol that they're provided, and that probably varies from trust to trust, but they're given a protocol and it's a simple yes or no. So have I tried giving them a biscuit?
Can we agree?
Yes or no. And if there are any difficulties, they refer to us, and the same with the fluids. So they try them with normal fluids, but if they have difficulties with normal fluids based on the protocol, they go to level 1. And level 1 thickened fluids, which is the 1 scoop of 200 mils. And then, so they move on to level 2, if level 1 was difficult. So they keep going up the hierarchy based on the protocol. So they train at level 4. And obviously when they're training, we can really use the EDSEF competencies to just for them to use a checklist that they've checked the things that are necessary to be checked.
Yeah, I love it. So we've talked about the assessment bit. We've talked about the diagnosis. You've explained very nicely to me the definition of dysphagia and the different stages. And then we've talked about these competencies, which I guess involves a little bit about the rehabilitation of somebody who perhaps has had a stroke. Tell me a little bit more about the rehab guidelines when it comes to someone who's had a stroke.
Yeah. So in terms of rehab guidelines, we have the National Clinical Guidelines for Stroke, which is really a set of recommendations for the care of people who have had a stroke. And they've been developed by a group of experts in stroke care, and they're updated regularly to reflect the latest evidence and best practice in the field. So the recent guidelines have actually just come out in 2023, a few months ago. And they really talk about diagnosis, management, rehabilitation across professionals. So be it physiotherapy, occupational therapy, speech and language therapy, psychology. They have rehab guidelines for really different areas. And it also includes long-term care and support and the things that we need to consider. So since stroke is such a specialist area, the recommendations are quite specific. So the recent guidelines suggest that people with a stroke should be considered to have potential to benefit from rehabilitation at any point after their stroke. Okay. So initially, the idea was that the recovery lasts up to the first 6 months or the first year. But really what they're saying is that at any point after their stroke, if they have the potential to improve, they should be offered rehabilitation options.
Okay.
And in terms of their swallowing, really, what we have options we offer is, like I explained before, during the bedside screen, we offer them some texture modification based on the ITSE levels. If they can manage that well and good, and we review them quite often to see if they can move up the hierarchy. And say someone's on a really soft and moist diet, and I can't manage harder textures, we do some behavioral therapy with them. So trying them on harder textures with our supervision to improve their chewing and things like that. So that's something we do to move them up back to normal diet and fluids. The other kind of therapy is just behavioral therapy, so different swallowing maneuvers. So there's a lot of evidence around what kind of swallowing maneuvers works within what kind of difficulties. So say someone has specific difficulties with moving their tongue, what kind of swallowing maneuvers do you need to use? What if they have specific difficulties in the pharyngeal stage, say they're not able to protect their airway or close their larynx well to avoid aspiration, what kind of therapy or maneuver can work there? So we insert all this from a video fluoroscopy or an endoscopy assessment before we start them on those swallow maneuvers or a rehabilitation program for their swallowing. So those are small different exercises based on where their weakness lies. Yeah. And it's usually intensive. So they'd be doing this behavioral therapy almost every day to try and improve their swallowing. We also have something called EMST, which is exploratory muscle strength training. So there's a lot of recent evidence that exploratory muscles are really helpful for swallowing. And it's a very small, tiny device that quite useful, and it really trains the expiratory muscles, and that improves patient swallowing as well. But this is something we can only start 3 months after a stroke. So there are certain criteria for it, and it's still gathering evidence in stroke. It's not as established as other techniques. And the recent stroke guidelines have actually recommended pharyngeal electrical stimulation as a method for rehabilitation of stroke. Not many trusts in the UK have access to this instrument. It's a specialist equipment where we insert electrodes into the throat and stimulate the pharynx for it to function better. And to help improve the pharyngeal stage, really. But more and more trusts are starting to use these equipments. And that's what is really recommended as best practice.
Yeah. No, that's brilliant. And I guess I'm a dietitian. So in terms of the rehab, the multidisciplinary work that you do as a speech and language therapist is very important, because we've talked a little bit about texture modified diets and making sure that you've got the right texture, because nutritionally, then somebody is able to get all the nutrients that they need. So how does your work look like in terms of the multidisciplinary team approach? And does this differ from working in stroke to perhaps other areas if you're a speech and language therapist in another area in the hospital?
Yeah, for sure. I think, so again, according to the stroke guidelines, what they recommend that each stroke rehabilitation unit should have a multidisciplinary team. So that should have a consultant physician, typically a neurologist. It should have nurses, healthcare assistants, physiotherapists, occupational therapists, speech and language therapists, dietitians, clinical psychologists, and social workers. So this is what they recommend. And yes, collaboration, I would say, is very vital in stroke. And my everyday job involves with liaising with all these different professionals for each and every patient. Obviously, the need or the level of need for each patient is very, very different. And it's always an individual approach. So for patients who have a really poor swallow, sometimes we're involved the most, and they might have some concomitant speech and language issues. And if they need an ED tube or a PEG, the dietitians get involved. So it really varies who's involved with which patient, but it's really good to have a total collaborative approach to discuss patient progress, to share insights, and ensure that everyone's really aligned with their rehabilitation goals that's usually set with the patient and the family. And the collaborative approach enables a comprehensive and really coordinated effort to support this patient's journey on their recovery. And stroke is an area where you expect a lot of spontaneous recovery, and it's very well supported by an MDT approach. Just to give you an example, I'm just coming back from an MDT discussion with a patient and their family. So this is a patient who's had a huge stroke on their left hemisphere of their brain. So they're really aphasic. So they have difficulties with both understanding and expressing language. And they have difficulties with the right half of their body. So they're paralyzed on their right half. So they can't do any activities of daily living independently. And she's also quite low in mood. So all professionals are really involved with her. Initially, she was on an NG tube, so dietetics was involved as well,
okay.
The doctors and nurses. So everybody was in the meeting today along with the family of this patient. And it was really good to give them an overall update of how her rehab journey is going. So I was telling them what we've been doing with her in speech and language therapy, how she's progressed. Mm-hmm. Now she's progressed from an NG to having full meal, so she's
amazing.
On normal fluids, and she's on a minced and moist diet, which is a level 5, but she's having full portions of that. She has a lot of difficulty chewing, so we can't progress her any further at this point in time. But then in order for her to feed herself, the occupational therapist has been involved for her to help feed with her left hand. She needs a plate guard so food is not falling out, so
falling
plays
off,
with
yeah.
the OT to give her some adapted cutlery so she can be as independent as she was before in feeding herself. And she also has mobility issues. So we help take the help of the physios to position her well in her wheelchair before she eats and drinks. So she has a swallow assessment, or she's getting ready for communication therapy where she has to sit for a good amount of time. So we liaise with the physios for her to be able to do that. And psychology has been involved with her in terms of her mood. And we support those sessions because she's really language impaired and we need to help the psychologist communicate well with
yeah.
her. So I had to do a detailed capacity assessment with her on where she wants to go after she's finished with her period of rehab in the hospital. We don't want to keep the patient longer in hospital
yeah.
again due to infections and other things. So even though she's really impaired with her language, she was able to very clearly indicate that she would like to go home. So the meeting really was about to discuss with the family how they feel about taking her back home, what needs they'll have to support with, give them an overall picture about the medical and nursing needs. So
yeah.
how many times she needs changed, how she should be moved and things like that. And it's a very comprehensive picture that the family gained
yeah.
in a meeting like this. And that's because we work so well collaboratively and consider the patient as a whole
yeah.
rather than individual difficulties that the patient has.
Yeah.
And this is, it's very different from other areas because it's a very specialist population, and anybody working in stroke needs to have specialist skills and training in order to meet the needs of the population.
Yeah, no, I love that. It really does demonstrate the power of multidisciplinary team working, and when it works well, how effective and powerful it is as well. Smriti, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time recording, and I've learned so much and I've completely had my eyes open to the different complexities and layers that there are just to what feels like a simple swallow. Now, at the end of each podcast, I like to ask our guests to leave 3 key take-home messages for our listeners. Now, the topic of our conversation today was learning about your role as a speech and language therapist working particularly in stroke rehabilitation.
Yeah. So I think the first take-home message really I would like to emphasize the importance of oral care or mouth care. Most
mm-hmm.
often in hospitals, it's sort of left to the nursing staff to clean someone's mouth or keep it clean. But for individuals who are nailed by mouth or not eating and drinking, these are the patients who most require mouth care.
Yeah.
And it really is everyone's job. So if you feel like a patient's mouth is not as clean as it should be, or even including someone who has dentures, dentures need to be cleaned as well. So just make sure you flag it to someone, or as a healthcare professional, I would suggest you try and clean someone's mouths to improve their quality of life. A clean mouth really goes a long way. If someone's mouth isn't as clean, it really deteriorates their general health and can lead in a lot of pneumonia and other health issues. So that's my first take home. The second is, if you're a healthcare professional that supports individuals with their meal times, see what recommendations are in place. So as speech and language therapists, we make some specific recommendations, be the fluid textures or the diet modifications which is suggested, but also using adapted cutlery where need be, feeding them if they can't feed themselves, or providing them all sorts of help that they might need during the mealtime. It's actually not very pleasant to be fed by someone, and it's something basic that we've done from really small ages of life, feeding ourselves. So just be very mindful that feeding someone might not be the most pleasant experience for the person experiencing it.
Okay.
And the third really is that stroke rehab is really important in a patient's journey. Just treating the stroke with a surgery or medication is not enough. A multidisciplinary rehabilitation approach where the MTT works collaboratively, setting goals with the patient and keeping the patient really as the center is vital for successful stroke rehabilitation.
Yeah, no, thank you. Those are some really practical and useful take-home messages. Smriti, thank you so much for your time. I've really enjoyed our conversation today.
Me too. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Inside Medical Nutrition. If you enjoyed the podcast and found the content useful, please share it with your colleagues. And consider subscribing so you never miss an episode. For more information on this topic or to share your feedback, please visit the Nestle Health Science N+ Hub or click on the link in the show notes.